The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Frank Aquila of Sullivan & Cromwell on issues to consider when adopting a rights plan. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis Legal Podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Frank Aquila is a partner in the Sullivan & Cromwell LLP Mergers and Acquisitions Group. His practice focuses on mergers, acquisitions, strategic alliances, and corporate governance matters for large multinational corporations. Mr. Aquila received his JD degree from Brooklyn Law School and received a Burton Award for Legal Achievement in 2005. He's recently written the Emerging Issues Analysis, Top 10 Issues to Consider When Adopting a Rights Plan, available from LexisNexis. Mr. Aquila, thanks very much for being part of this LexisNexis Legal Podcast.
Thank you, Steve. Happy to be with you.
First, I guess the question is, what is a rights plan?
Rights plans were something that were put together in the midst of the mid-1980s. As you might recall, that was a period in which there was a great deal of hostile M&A activity. And quite honestly, U.S. corporations did not have a lot in the way of takeover defenses. So the New York M&A bar put together the so-called poison pill or rights plan. And essentially what a rights plan does is it puts a bar on the amount of shares that the unsolicited bidder or really any shareholder can own in the corporation. And it can be 20%, 15%, 10%. Some cases we've seen it even lower than that. But essentially what it does is it says to the bidder, you need to come to the board before you go over that threshold, that 10 or 15 or 20%. And if you do go over that threshold without getting the board's approval, effectively what happens is that these rights, the rights that are in the rights plan, then get released. All the shareholders other than the shareholder that's gone over the threshold has the right to, in effect, purchase more shares of the company at a discounted price so that the shareholder that has gone through the threshold, not only are they being diluted in terms of how many shares or votes they have in the corporation, but their economic value is being diluted. And you can question the efficacy of it, but the fact is that no one has knowingly gone through a rights plan. They've gone maybe up to the rights plan, but then they've gone and negotiated with the board.
Sounds like a logical kind of thing to have in place, but I understand that fewer companies have rights plans. Why is that?
Well, what you saw was from the mid-1980s till really the early 2000s, putting in place a rights plan was something that most U.S. public companies did. If you had a $200 billion market cap, or you had a controlling shareholder, or significant block of shareholders, you probably didn't worry about putting in a rights plan. But roughly 70% of the S&P 500 had rights plans in place in 2000, 2001. What happened was that, and I think people understood this before, that 2001 period, was that rights plans were so effective at thwarting hostile bids, unsolicited bids, that institutional shareholders didn't like that because their view is they should be able to buy and sell their stock at any point in time. And to the extent that you were preventing the hostile bidder from going forward with their bid at presumably a premium price, they were not getting the opportunity necessarily of taking that bid. So they always had opposition to it. There was a sea change in 2001, 2002. Remember the Enron WorldCom meltdown, that led to Sarbanes-Oxley and really the empowerment of institutional shareholders who own 75%, maybe more, of the shares of U.S. public companies. So the pressure from the institutional shareholders since Sarbanes-Oxley has really led more and more companies either to repeal their pill, so redeem their pill, cancel it, or when the rights plan expires, because typically they had 10-year terms, not to renew their pill. So that's why we've gone from, you know, 2,200 companies in the U.S. having rights plans in 2001 to, I believe it's less than 1,000 having them today.
In the latest emerging issues analysis you've written, top 10 issues to consider when adopting a rights plan, you devote a good deal of time to structuring an optimal board process. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. One of the things that I think is very important to understand is the fact that we've gone from a period where rights plans, poison pills, were pretty much standard in the corporate governance, corporate makeup, to a period where fewer and fewer companies have rights plans. However, the legal underpinning for the ability to put in place a rights plan has never changed. From the very first cases in Delaware in the mid-1980s, the household decision, to the most recent case, or one of the most recent cases, the Selectica case, where the Delaware Chancery Court upheld a rights plan at 5%. It was to protect net operating losses. Basically, the courts in Delaware and really all the other states have said that boards have the right to, within their reasonable exercise of their fiduciary duty, put in place impediments to take over, or in the case of the Selectica matter, impediments to someone screwing up their NOL status, if that's in the best interest of the corporation. So if you use a rights plan, you can be sure that a court will permit you to have a rights plan so long as you really have the right sort of process. And the reason that it's important to get the process right is for two reasons. One is what I've just mentioned. Having a record, having the ability to show to the court that the advisors just didn't come in or management just didn't come in and say, you know, let's adopt a rights plan with a 10% threshold or a 15% threshold, and that was that. You want to show that the board really was engaged in this process, that they really understood what they were doing, why they were doing it, and that they really were making a reasonable judgment. The second reason that you want to have that sort of thoughtful process is rights plans in the general perception, you know, that they're sort of one size fits all. They're really not. You need to gear the rights plan to the particular company and the particular situation. So therefore, it is important that management and the advisors, in preparing to bring something like this to the board, think through all the various issues, and when they do so, present that in a way that will allow the board to have a thoughtful discussion of those issues, so that it's not just a knee-jerk approval, but that it's an approval that they've come to after being properly informed, debating it, understanding it, and then making a determination that doing this would be in the best interest of the company.
You know, it sounds like, based on the way you're presenting this, that there could be different types of rights plans. Is that the case?
Well, first of all, most rights plans, if you look at them, they will have many common features. But if the rights plan is put together in a thoughtful fashion, you will see that there are differences. One of the differences that you will see is what is the purpose of the rights plan? If it is to block someone coming in and buying 100% of the company's shares without negotiating with the board, and of course the board is going to be negotiating to get the best price, the best terms, and maybe is actually going to reject the takeover bid because it's not the right time to sell the company, the price is too low, whatever it may be. But there are other purposes for rights plans. And I think that was, I mentioned the Selectica case a moment ago, that was very different. They weren't concerned necessarily about someone coming in and running a proxy contest and removing the board, or coming in and doing a tender offer and taking control at a cheap price. What they were concerned about was that they wanted to make sure that their net operating loss, essentially a tax benefit that the company had.
And that's the NOL you spoke of.
The NOL, a very significant asset of that company, that it wasn't going to be lost. And so therefore, in order to preserve that NOL, and sort of beyond the scope of the article or this interview, but they had to make sure that they didn't have any new shareholders becoming 5% shareholders, so they put the 4.99% threshold in place. If you did that in the typical takeover battle, I suspect, without something more issues going on, that you would not have a court being comfortable with that. Again, depends on the facts and circumstances. But in this case, they were very clear about what they were trying to do, what they were trying to protect. It was a huge asset of the company, and the court in Delaware approved of it for that reason.
Talk about the decision between adopting a pill today and putting a pill on the shelf, as it were.
Well, one of the things that we used to like to do was to put the rights plan in place and have it out there, and that way everybody knew the threshold was 15% or 10% or 20%, whatever it may be. Those were the terms, and essentially it became part of the corporate governance fabric of the company. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, the pressure over the last decade from institutional shareholders to not have rights plans, or not at least have traditional rights plans, has meant that fewer and fewer companies have put them in place. The advantage of putting the plan in place, as I said, was it's there, everybody knows it, those are the ground rules. The disadvantage today of putting a rights plan in place is that the shareholder, institutional shareholder rights groups may very well recommend withholding votes for the election of your directors. You're not going to get very good, corporate governance scores, things like that. So you have something in place that may not be particularly relevant at the moment because there's no potential takeover threat, and yet you're getting bad grades from risk metrics and groups like that. So the equation that many companies have had to debate is whether to put something in place and get that negative reaction, or to wait until the time. And I think many companies are opting to put a pill on the shelf. And what that means is that you're prepared, if something happens, to relatively quickly present something to the board and have a debate with the board. The advantage of doing it is you can then really narrowly focus that rights plan on whatever the perceived threat may be. And so you may have a situation where you have a shareholder that's already come in and bought up a big percentage of your stock, and that may be something you have to deal with, but at least you're able to freeze things into place. My suspicion is that some companies will, because of their shareholder makeup or whatever, keep a rights plan in place. But I think most companies are going to go the so-called on-the-shelf route.
How do you deal with derivatives?
Well, derivatives are increasingly becoming a very big issue. I think what we have seen over the course of the last, 4 or 5 years is that in many ways, and this is particularly true of hedge funds, their stake in the company is not just direct, meaning owning the shares or even owning options, but through a range of different derivatives. And this is an area where there's a lot of debate. There may very well be statutory and regulatory changes in the way they're accounted for under 13D. But one of the things that you want to do, and it particularly in the case of having it sort of on the shelf and ready to go, if you think you have either a hostile bidder or hedge funds who are in your stock and are using a lot of derivatives, what you're going to want to do is to attempt to capture their interest, their indirect interest, in saying, okay, that's when you trigger the pill. One of the things to be thinking about, though, is, again, unlike buying a share of stock, derivatives, which are financial instruments that change over time and become more sophisticated over time, you can't necessarily know today every single way in which derivatives are going to be used in the future. So when you put a pill in place, you should be thinking about who are the parties that you're concerned about, what sort of things do they do in the marketplace, and what is the technology for derivatives at that point in time.
Even with fewer companies adopting them, is a rights plan still an effective takeover defense?
I think that it most certainly is. To a certain extent, if, and this is sort of proving it by the negative, if rights plans were not so effective, we would not see the opposition to rights plans by groups like Risk Metrics and Glass Lewis and the Corporate Library. The reason that they're opposed to rights plans, and again, they do have exceptions and they do understand that companies need to put rights plans into place, but the reason that, by and large, institutional shareholders dislike rights plans, it's just generally as a matter of principle, is that they are effective. Quite honestly, Steve, what I tell boards, and I think my partners tell boards, are this, that a rights plan, whether you have it in place today, you take it off the shelf when needed, having a rights plan does not prevent any and all takeovers. If someone comes along with a very high price and the shareholders want to take it and there are no impediments, they have the financing, they don't have an antitrust or regulatory problem, and there's, in effect, a willing buyer and a willing seller on both sides, in that situation, ultimately, you are not going to prevent that unsolicited bid from being successful by having a rights plan in place. However, by having the rights plan in place, you allow the board to have the time to consider the bid, explore options, see if there are other alternatives, and ultimately, if the decision is to sell to the bidder, then negotiate the best possible deal, best possible terms, highest available price with that bidder. And at the end of the day, the tool that gives the board the best chance of being able to do that is the rights plan, because the potential dilution that a bidder or institutional shareholders supporting that bidder would suffer is so great that they're going to, and I think history shows us, that they have gone up to the threshold but haven't wanted to intentionally go beyond the threshold. And that says to me that it is a very effective takeover defense. Won't necessarily stop the sale of the company, but it sure gives the board of directors at an important point in time a very effective tool to negotiate with potential buyers.
It sounds like a good way to set some guidelines in place.
Yes, it basically says come and talk to the board, negotiate with the board, be prepared to pay a full and fair price, and maybe then you'll get to buy the company.
What would you suggest to attorneys practicing in this area who are dealing with rights plans?
First, I think that they need to really study rights plans. I think it's easy to think, as whether you're a banker or a corporate lawyer or a corporate executive or a board member, you know, I've been around rights plans my entire professional career. I know what they are. I know how they work. And generally, I think most sophisticated business people have a pretty good understanding of rights plans. I think that far fewer, though, understand necessarily the nuance, the history, and understand, you know, why there are certain provisions in these rights plans, why the rights plans that a company might put in place in 2010 are different, fundamentally different from the rights plans that were put in place in 1985. And it isn't just that lawyers have added more words, it's that lawyers have reacted to cases, they've reacted to particular situations, they've built in, if you will, new technology that make the rights plans more effective and also more, you know, user-friendly for boards and companies to work with. So study, and know the area well, and you'll be able to guide your client, advise the board, and ultimately craft a rights plan that will be most effective for the circumstance.
As always, Mr. Aquila, appreciate you taking the time out to come on and explain some of these issues and talking about rights plans. And we appreciate you being part of this LexisNexis Legal Podcast and look forward to having you back again.
Always good to chat with you.
Frank Aquila of Sullivan & Cromwell. Thank you for listening to the LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Copyright 2010 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. Visit the LexisNexis communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. LexisNexis, Total Practice Solutions. I'm Steve Bursler. Thank you for listening.